This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, and this is it, folks. End of an era.
TMRS 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5. All three engines up and burning. 2, 1, 0, and liftoff. The final liftoff of Atlantis on the shoulders of the space shuttle. America will continue the dream.
A week ago today, Atlantis set off on the final mission of America's space shuttle program. Amid all the excitement about the historic moment, it was easy to forget that the shuttle does actually have a mission, part of which is research. In addition to the astronauts, 30 mice are aboard the Atlantis. Scientists at UNC Chapel Hill and NC State Joint Department of Biomedical Engineering are using those mice for research. Furry creatures are testing a drug that could help prevent the severe bone density loss that accompanies long space flights. Leading that study is Professor Ted Bateman. He was at last week's launch at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, going back this weekend for the landing. But before he does, he stopped by our studios to tell us about the experiment. Welcome, Ted. Good to have you.
Thank you for having me. Gives me goosebumps to hear that launch again.
It's pretty amazing. Well, and this one, of course, being the last, but this is an experiment that could be very important as manned or human space flights continue. Tell us about the experiment.
Sure. We've got 30 mice up on a space shuttle right now, and it's docked to International Space Station. And we are primarily interested in working with a group of people from University of Colorado, the biotechnology company Amgen, and Harvard, looking at how spaceflight causes bone loss, and testing a potential very new class of osteoporosis therapy that will build new bone that Amgen is developing. So we know that astronauts and mice lose bone very rapidly in space. I mean, astronauts lose bone about 5 times the rate as postmenopausal women here on Earth. So it's a great model for aging. It's a great accelerated model for what humans experience here on Earth.
And we've known about it for a long time. This idea of losing bone density has been probably as old as pretty much the space program itself, certainly any kind of prolonged flights. But what do we know about it? What do we know about why?
When we remove gravity, I mean, our skeletal system is very efficient, and it senses that it doesn't need the structure to resist the stresses and strains. So what causes the bone loss to be so rapid is that we have a very rapid increase in bone resorption combined with a suppression of bone formation. So we call this in the bone world an uncoupling of bone formation and bone resorption. And that's what's really unique about bone loss in space in astronauts.
And something causes that, and it's either too much of something or too little of something. But anyway, it's affected by gravity, and that's
exactly
what signals the bones to either make more or stop.
Those are the basics.
You
yep.
figured that out, and now come up with a drug, and these mice all – and there's a – so there are 30 mice in space who've been injected?
Yes, 30 mice have been injected, half with this drug called a sclerostin antibody and half with a placebo. And we expect that sclerostin levels in these mice to increase because of space flight, and the drug will very molecularly, specifically block this increase in sclerostin levels.
So it's an increase. So weightlessness produces an increase
in sclerostin, which causes a decrease in bone formation.
There you go.
And the drug will block that.
And it's going to block that. And you've got a control group down here in Houston.
We've got in Kennedy Space
Kennedy.
Center. Yep.
Okay. And then you're going to go back. So what do you expect? Has anything like this been tried before?
We have worked with Amgen on flights in the past. We flew an osteoporosis drug a decade ago, and that drug actually came on market a year ago. So it's really exciting to see the slow process of drug development be connected to space flight and testing different therapies like that.
First of all, I have to say it's just cool that it's not only our genetics that determine, in other words, our history that determines your bone density if you happen to have been from a certain place, and the fact that your body's always reacting to changing conditions. We are in constant communication with our environment and giving signals about how much and how little.
That's a great way to put it. We are in constant communication with our environment, and removing gravity is a huge environmental change.
Why doesn't it replace itself? So when astronauts get back, famously, they simply don't replace the bone density they've lost, but here they are back at Earth, and the gravity's back to normal.
Because some irreversible changes happen. I mean, we lose connectedness of within the spongy trabecular bone, and that can't be recovered. So the body tries to adapt. And interestingly, it adapts in a way that's very similar to aging. It places bone in different locations, and it adapts in its own way to reintroduction to gravity.
And we know that this phenomenon is common in women, as you said, postmenopausal women is the other cohort that you'd be looking at. Is there any similarity in there in terms of the cause, or are they just coincidental?
There's certainly a similarity. Women with postmenopausal osteoporosis have a very large increase in bone resorption, and this can't be recovered. It is similar in that way. The astronauts also have a suppression of bone formation, which is an added twist.
And so does this research have implications for osteoporosis here on Earth?
Exactly. I mean, the promotion of bone formation is a gap within osteoporosis treatment. There's only one drug that's available. It's extremely expensive. It requires a daily injection. So this promotion of bone formation is needed within osteoporosis treatment to actually grow new bone rather than only suppress loss.
And of course, the other side of this is if we're to continue, and certainly human space flight is going to continue one way or another, and for those long trips, if we want to go to Mars and beyond, licking this problem is vital.
It's critical. I mean, on a trip to Mars, astronauts are going to be in space for on the order of 30 months or more, and exposure to microgravity and reduced gravity on Mars will cause a large decline in bone mass and strength, and they're at real risk for having a fracture during the mission.
That's interesting. And, of course, then you're in trouble.
Then they're in big trouble. I mean, you can imagine they don't have access to doctors or hospital. Communicating to Mars is difficult. I mean, you've got a delay of up to 20 minutes in communication if depending on orbital mechanics.
And of course, healing is much more difficult when you're in that condition.
Yes. So we've got another investigator. We've got a whole host of investigators, like 20 investigators studying different parts of these mice. And one is looking at healing. And that's it's a very important point that healing is delayed in spaceflight.
Now, so what happens when the mice get back?
So they land, we get the mice back about 3.5 hours later, and we take their bone density, and then we start collecting tissues. So we want the tissues as soon as possible so we can look at cellular changes and molecular changes and minimize the readaptation to gravity.
Now, who takes care of the mice when they're in space?
They are in a self-contained habitat that gives them food and water, but the astronauts look at them every day. And tell us that they're doing well and make sure they have enough food and water. But we hear that they're doing great.
So far, so good. They're all
doing it.
They're all
so
still
far.
Drinking the Tang, I guess.
Exactly.
That's good. You have a long history with this, and your encounter with space and the space program began almost about 20 years ago.
20 years ago. So 20 years ago today, I was at Kennedy Space Center when I was an undergrad. I was at a program called the Space Life Sciences Training Program, and we got introduced to research at NASA and life sciences, and we got to meet astronauts and got to see the space shuttles. It was a great experience, and everything I'm doing now can be traced back to that summer.
You were at the launch of the final Atlantis flight, the final shuttle flight. What was that like?
Oh, that was spectacular. I mean, it's just thrilling. I mean, it's exciting because we've got an experiment up there, I mean, first and foremost, but it's the last space shuttle launch. And the weather prediction was very poor, and they had a very last-second mechanical glitch. So a lot of extra drama thrown in there with the weather and the mechanical glitch.
A lot of people like you had the opportunity to go to NASA camps, all sorts of opportunities to be down there, experience it firsthand, get very excited about space. Exploration is going to continue. If it does now, it'll be more or less privatized. What do you think is the future? Where are we going from here?
So these commercial companies are developing new launch vehicles, and they'll be resupplying space station, but not with astronauts on them. So the University of Colorado Group will continue to fly experiments up in space. But it is not the same if the astronauts aren't on there. And I think it's quite unfortunate that we have to send our astronauts to Russia to get them on our own International Space Station. So the work will continue, but U.S. cannot get its own astronauts into space.
Now, a lot of folks are saying, look, we really don't need to do that anymore. It's great for public relations, but really the work of science can be done without the risk and without the cost of sending humans into space. Let's just do it that way and benefit by the research and keep the cost down.
It is not possible to ask the fundamental question, how does the body respond without gravity, without sending animals in space or experiments in space? Science is sometimes expensive. I mean, we've got ground-based astronomy versus the Hubble telescope. I mean, you can't argue that the Hubble telescope is extremely expensive but very beneficial. we need to continue to do science in space.
Do you think we will? Do you think we'll get back to putting more humans and will those Mars missions really take place?
I'm an optimist, so I think we will get there. Under the current environment, it's going to be very, very difficult to start to make progress. But humans explore. I mean, that's human nature. And space is where we're going to explore next.
Thanks so much for being with us, Ted. Great to talk with you.
Thank you.
Ted Bateman is associate professor in the UNC Chapel Hill, NC State Joint Department of Biomedical Engineering, headed to Florida this weekend to pick up his 30 mice from the space shuttle Atlantis. Got a lot of music ahead. You know, Ted, that mice sing. You know, did you ever send singing mice into space?
No, I've not sent singing mice into space.
Well, we would have them here on the show because we actually have two bands coming up and yet no singing mice. Stay tuned. Filthy Bird, The Small Ponds, coming up on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio Broadcast Service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. Invasion. Tonight.